Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm film critic April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, producer, and we talk in depth about their fave genre film, maybe one that influenced their own work. And today, I'm so very happy to welcome writer, director Mira Menon.
Hey,
I love
that's me.
Oh, yes. This is where I talk.
All right.
For those of you who are not familiar with Mira's work, let me give you a little primer. So Mira is a writer, director, and editor. In 2013, her feature directorial debut, Farrah Goes Bang, premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival. The film is about a young woman traveling across the country with her friends to canvass for John Kerry's election. Oh, long time ago.
Nostalgia. Oh, nostalgia piece.
To canvass for John Kerry's election while searching for her first sexual experience. As the film's co-writer and director, Mira was awarded the inaugural Nora Ephron Prize for a groundbreaking woman filmmaker by Tribeca and Vogue. In 2016, Mira directed her second feature, a female-driven Wall Street drama titled Equity, produced by Sarah Megan Thomas and Alicia Reiner, and also starring Anna Gunn, which is
correct.
It's a
not
pretty,
bad.
Pretty great cast.
You don't have to do much when you have her in front of the screen. Yeah.
And that film is a look at women on Wall Street, focusing on one corrupted woman trying to play with the boys while she becomes a bad role model for the women underneath her. Equity premiered at the 2016 Sundance Film Festival and was released that summer by Sony Pictures Classics. And recently, Mira has been directing a lot of television, which I've been seeing is a running theme for a lot of the women that I have on here.
Great.
A lot of them direct a great deal of television. So Mira's been on Snowfall for FX, Halt and Catch Fire, and Fear the Walking Dead for AMC, Man in the High Castle for Amazon, The Exorcist for Fox, Blood Drive and The Magicians for Sci-Fi, and then Glow for Netflix. We've had, I think, you're the third director we've had from Glow on the
really?
Show. Yeah.
Who else have you had?
Well, Lynn Shelton.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you had Lynn. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
My God. She's such a girl crush of all
and
time.
And we also had Mariana Palka, who is Vicky the Viking, who are all very in good company.
Oh, man.
Today, you have selected a movie that I have not seen, which is something I love, and it is a Gareth Edwards film, Monsters. Could you tell me why that's the one that you selected to talk about today?
You know, I think it's just one I've been thinking about a lot lately for a number of reasons. I mean, when I think about movies that that I hold on to and that I kind of try and watch more than once, they're either movies that, like, I watch and I'm like, how the fuck do they do that? Or like Dunkirk, I watched that and I was like, I don't understand how that movie got made, you know, or like how you make that movie. I don't have my 10,000 hours in it to understand how you make that movie. But Monsters, I watched and I was like, oh, this is a movie whose process I understand, and it's so well executed in terms of what it's trying to do, but it's also so accessible in its filmmaking that I just really appreciate it as a model for the kind of scope of story you can tell with a low budget indie if you think through it and kind of engage with it in the right way, you know?
Yeah, I would totally agree. And for those who have not seen Monster, I'm going to let you know that today's episode will give you some spoilers, but that should not stop you from listening before you watch. My motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you want to pause and peep Monsters first, this is your chance. And hopefully you're back. Okay, let's give you a quick rundown on what Monsters is. I'm going to fly through this synopsis.
Okay.
Written and directed by Gareth Edwards in 2010, Monsters tells the story of a conflict photographer who's tasked with finding and bringing back his boss's daughter from Mexico. Oh, and Mexico has been subject to rolling attacks by giant alien life forms. Yeah.
That side note.
That's
context.
Side note. Huge. Scoot McNairy plays Calder, the brash photographer, and Whitney Able plays Samantha, the daughter. Calder would rather not do this assignment. He'd rather be taking photographs of the tragedies left behind by the monsters so he can make some cash. The two embark on a train to the coast so they can catch a ferry to the States before the mandatory evacuation, because they've been doing these evacuations when they know that the monsters are going to come. Because in this timeline, scientists can predict a little accuracy of which towns will get hit and when. So Calder and Sam are running against the clock, but they're also kind of having a lot of fun, even as things go really, really wrong. Calder sleeps with a woman who steals their passports. Oh, no. However, and thus sets off a trek down a dangerous river and through a jungle into the quote-unquote infected zone, or the place where the aliens have laid their eggs. Sam and Calder get caught in a monster attack and have to make it over the United States border wall by themselves. Yes, there is a giant border wall in this story. Okay, that's it in a nutshell.
Yeah. I kind of forgot the border wall is kind of like this culminating, or one of the culminating images of the movie, and it's obviously so relevant right now as an image to even like wrap your mind around.
I had to ask you if that was one. I was just like, oh shit, there's a border wall.
There's
also a little bit of discussion between the characters and between the Central American and Mexican characters in here about what that border wall actually does, which I thought was fascinating.
Yeah, like the kind of the arrogance of Americans to think that that's actually going to be able to kind of protect some idea of what they're trying to hold on to. It's like it's very, yeah, it feels very kind of relevant to the way the wall is discussed as a kind of, yeah, a metaphor for protection or some sense of like a false sense of safety or identity or kind of a coherent identity. Right now.
I mean, there's this definitely a political aspect to this film, even though the romance, the romance is like, you know, first and foremost. Right. And then there's aliens, but the romance is there. And then there's this third thing that it's the politics, which I was just not expecting.
And I think that's what I really like about it is the kind of foreground and background, you know, like the foreground of this relationship, this road movie, this kind of like neo-realist, kind of road movie, Motorcycle Diaries kind of road movie at the foreground of it. But this backdrop of this world that has been in kind of meshed or kind of immersed in a reality of this kind of the infected or the alien kind of border zone between the U.S. and Mexico that's been in place for a certain number of years, and that we're already kind of in the middle of an accepted reality, you know.
Which I thought, you know, that's a fascinating thing for Gareth Edwards to do in writing this script, because, you know, when it comes to like War of the Worlds or other things, you know, it's a big thing to have these monsters introduced into the world, and then you have to have the reactions of like, oh, this is what it's like to see it for the first time.
Right.
But having it, you know, already set up, like we're dealing with it. This is the reality. Like monsters exist, and we have to just kind of accept it and figure out how to survive alongside it.
There's already a set of rules established around how to deal with it, but there's still a discovery element in the kind of progression of the story, and that the main characters have never seen one of these things in real life.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is a journalist, and so like is a photojournalist, and so has a particularly vested interest in actually witnessing or bearing witness to what these things look like. So there's that mystery still kind of like is able to pull the story along, but the world around them has adjusted to the reality of monsters, which is interesting.
And one of the reasons why I love that is because Edwards thought of that because he wanted to do this movie on a low budget, which is hilarious because it becomes such an amazing tool for storytelling, but it also was born from being cheap.
That's exactly why I'm interested in it, is because and it's so effective narratively that like the nature of the monster, the visuals around it, what it really looks like, what these aliens really look like, is really kind of withheld from you as a viewer until the very end. And that I think is a more interesting storytelling choice, but clearly one born of like having a very limited amount of money and ability to complete a certain number of visual effects shots. And of course, like he did all of them himself. And so he was smart about that approach. But I think it also services the story.
Yeah. I mean, the alternative is hiring a ton of extras.
Right.
In Central America and in Mexico to portray very scared people running around.
Right.
But instead, you know, they have regular people who are reacting as though, you know, everything is you know, it's just the way that it is.
Right. And they've learned how to deal with it. And there's like a kind of system and a kind of an order and operations, you know, kind of like tour guides that can like take you through these spaces, or guides that can take you through these spaces and that are experienced in knowing what these things look like. So yeah, they can live an ordinary life, or they're trying to live an ordinary life despite these extraordinary circumstances, which is super interesting. Yeah, just an interesting premise.
So when you were working on, you know, Fair Goes Bang or even Equity, or any of the TV shows that you've shot, has there been storylines that have been born from being cheap?
Well, my first movie was like that. The one I made with like just some friends from film school and from college. You know, we raised money on Kickstarter. Fair Goes Bang was like that. And it was a road movie for this reason. I think road movies are really convenient to low budget structures. If you can get access to locations that will allow you to kind of diversify the journey and kind of create at least the impression or illusion that you're going, that you're traveling through space and time and all this stuff.
Yeah.
You can do it cheaply, because at the end of the day, we constructed it as a road movie because we knew at the end of the day, if we really had no money, all we needed was a car and good actors, you know, and we could make a lot of those exterior scenes, interior, just keep everything in the car at the end, you know, if we really had to. So it had that flexibility, you know. I think that was very much the reason we made it a road movie, is because we knew we'd have no money to make it. Yeah.
I mean, you were also working on a lower budget with Equity as well.
Yeah. And we were shooting, it was a Wall Street movie, it was set in New York, and we were shooting it in Philadelphia. And you know, so we had to shoot a lot of it inside. It was a lot of interior scenes. I mean, the reason I love a movie like Monsters, and the reason it kind of still kind of jumps out to me as something I'd aspire to try and do even the next time around, is that they went to the real location and filmed in the real location. So they were able to approach their filmmaking in an additive way. Everything around them was adding to the palette they were able to photograph. When you're cheating one location for another, like we had to do for Equity, we had to shoot Philly for New York, you're constantly...
Which has to happen a lot.
Happens all the time. I mean, a lot of the TV stuff I've been doing does the same thing. You're constantly having to take away. You're constantly having to subtract from the things around you. And it just limits your ability to react in terms of the visual palette of the film and what's right in front of you. Even with Fair Goes Bang, we had to do that. We shot a lot of it in L.A., even though they were traveling across the country. And so we were constantly having to choose our frames based on where palm trees were.
Yes.
Like framing out palm trees. We were just on constant palm tree watch. And and it, yeah.
It's like a boom mic dropping in, but palm trees
but
instead.
But palm trees, yeah. And I think, what I've kind of learned and what I kind of aspire to going forward as a filmmaker is to really try and shoot stories in the location that they're meant to be told, so you don't have to be distracted by that kind of subtraction, you know.
Does that mean that you would also maybe want to be writing stories where you would be like, okay, this is an interesting location. It may not be this place, but I might have easy access to something,
yeah.
You know, like where they're like, okay, let's go to Central America.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think writing to location, I mean, like the other movie that comes to mind with that is like Ghost Story, David Lowery's latest film.
Sure,
like just like finding a house, you know, and telling that he could bulldoze as like a kind of central idea around which to shape a story, you know.
Yeah.
I think writing to location when you're dealing with low budget is something I have learned the hard way.
I want to talk about the casting of this film, which I always find casting stories wildly fascinating.
Yeah.
Because Scoot McNairy and Whitney Able are a real-life couple, and that's essentially why they got the part, because Edwards didn't want to risk that his two leads wouldn't have good chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
So McNairy was cast first because Edwards had watched In Search of a Midnight Kiss, which is a very low-budget film. McNairy was in a few years before Monsters, and apparently that performance sold Edwards so much that he was willing to also cast Scoot's girlfriend, now wife, but his girlfriend at the time, Edwards thought that Whitney Able was just too beautiful for the part. He was like, shit, she is too beautiful. I want this to be realistic.
Yeah.
And he was like, well, they've got really great chemistry.
That's
which is
so
the opposite,
funny.
Right? Normally you'd be like, get the hottest chick in this room.
I know. Yeah, it speaks to him as a film. That's really funny because she is distractingly beautiful. Like, the first 5 minutes you watch it, you're like, really? Is that a person? Is that not the alien? You know, like, that's like a, yeah, that's definitely, and she kind of actually looks like Mackenzie Davis from Halt and Catch Fire.
She does. A little, she does.
Which is funny, yeah, because Scoot is on that show. And yeah, so, yeah, I mean, I think that really shines through, right? I mean, part of what's so compelling about the movie is watching them interact with one another, and it feels, and I think was, largely improvised, their dialogue with one another, and it feels very familiar and flirty. And yeah, I mean, if you even think about just those scenes where they're like walking down roads together, they really, they feel like physically engaged with one another, and that probably, yeah, stems from their real life compatibility and chemistry.
Do you? I have been lucky enough to be privy to your casting process and how you work with actors a little bit.
Oh, we did that.
But
yeah.
I was curious if you could explain, you know, how you've worked with it thus far. TV, you don't have really control over that kind of thing.
No, unless it's like day players and stuff on an episode. Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of it, I mean, for the main example that comes to mind was casting Anna in Equity. You know, for us and for me, it was really about the fact that, like, she read the script. She really responded to it. She wanted to meet. I went to her house and we just talked for like 2 hours. And we just like were, it was a very easy, instantly synced in, like instantly in sync conversation. And I think that, beyond the fact that, like, of course, she was already, like, it was already an understanding that she's an exceptional screen.
You're like, oh, I've seen
presence.
Breaking Bad. Yeah, I think I can.
Yeah, I've seen her work. I watched her reel. but that, to me, is so critically important that you can have a kind of seamless and connected ongoing conversation with an actor, and that it be the type of thing, like a friendship, like a good friendship that you can sustain for months and months at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was pretty instant with Anna. And I think that's what I've kind of I learned from that experience, is the importance of having, just that kind of conversational chemistry.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break and then we'll be right back. And I want to be talking to you about some of the kind of seat of your pants filming that Edwards was doing, because I thought it was fascinating. Okay. One quick break. We'll be right back. Hello, everyone. This is your host, April Wolf, and I want to tell you about the upcoming Max Fun Drive. The drive runs from April 2nd through April 13th, and this is a big deal for us. This is how we keep the lights on at Maximum Fun and get to make this informative, entertaining show every week. So keep an ear out during the drive, because we'll be running some really great episodes that we've been saving just for this event. We'll also be giving away gifts for the new and upgrading members. It's just a great time for all. So if you listen to the show and you want to support some quality film journalism in the podcasting space, you can become a Max Fun member. And the Max Fun Drive is the best time to join. So don't miss out. The Max Fun Drive starts April 2nd. Welcome back. You're listening to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm here today talking with Mira Menon about monsters. Okay, so in terms of working with non-actors, I love people's process with that. That happens quite a bit now. So Edwards had said that, quote, virtually everyone on screen is a real person we managed to convince to be in our film. I found you could get really good performances out of non-actors as long as you didn't tell them what to do. Everyone in the world can do an Oscar-winning performance of themselves without even trying. The downside of this is that Scoot and Whitney had to dance around all this random behavior. As a result, the idea of scripting the film went out the window. Instead, I had a loose paragraph describing each scene with just the main points that had to be hit. How the actors carried this out was left up to them. Thank God I was lucky enough to find Scoot and Whitney. I'm still amazed how seamless both of my editor, Colin Goody, made all this look. But it really wasn't.
Yeah. And again, I'm sure that comes, it works because they probably just shot hundreds of hours of this stuff, I'm sure.
I think he said something like 110 hours.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
This is a 90-minute movie. So,
There you go. Yeah.
What is anything you know, working with non-actors like that, finding performances, is that something that has ever appealed to you?
Yeah, totally. I mean, like American Honey, I mean, like those kind of movies. And I mean, we did it in one scene in Farrago's Wang. We had our main character show up to a convenience store, and she's Iranian-American, and we don't really talk about it through the course of the movie. But there's this one scene where she goes into a gas station, and the guy that's running the gas station, that owns the gas station, is also Iranian, and kind of clocks that when he sees her ID and starts talking to her in their language. And it happened to be that the guy whose gas station we were renting for the day in Oxnard was from Iran and could speak to our actress. And we were like, well, would you mind being on camera? And so we put him on camera. And it was like, to me, it feels like the most authentic kind of textural piece in the film for that reason, because mm-hmm. it's just the real guy. And yeah, I mean, I think if you... I mean, I guess for these kind of like bit parts where it's just like kind of dialogue or interactions or transactional kind of scenes in the course of a movie, it seems to be something that can be really additive and help you just kind of create that texture and color and reality too, especially when you're talking about a sense of place in a kind of foreign country like mm-hmm. this. I don't know how they would have... How he would have done it any other way? It would have rang false. I mean, I think you would have been able to smell it if he hadn't approached it this way.
Oh God, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got the guy who's selling the ferry tickets.
Yeah,
who's great. A quote unquote non actor.
Yeah.
Who's very matter of fact that can't get to the ferry. And you're like, no, like it's a bureaucratic kind of thing. Like the ferry's gone. This is the only way you can do it.
We have one ticket to, ferry ticket to America.
Okay. Let me check.
Hay tiquetes para ahora?
Not for today, for tomorrow.
What time?
7:00
in the morning.
That's fine.
That's the last ferry.
Okay.
7,
okay.
Yeah.
How much?
That will be 5,000 colones.
5,000?
Yeah, 5,000. Yeah, it's the only way to go.
$5,000 is a lot of money.
Yes, I know, but this is the only possibility right now.
How do you not have tickets? There are people
waiting
in line.
What are these people doing?
Yeah, the people just waiting to go through the land.
What do you mean by land?
These people are going through the effective zone. As you can see there, the effective zone is very risky. If you got the money, you go by ferry.
And then you've got the there's a woman that they stay with when the train has to turn back.
Yeah.
And so they stay with the woman and their family. And I keep thinking about how strange that must have been.
Yeah.
For these people to agree to be in this movie.
I know. Yeah. I mean, they must have had like a Mexican Central American line producer or fixer of some sort that was able to kind of at least establish explain what was going on, you know, like in
yes.
terms of like why they were doing it this way and like what these people needed to be doing. But maybe also, I mean, that's also the reason, because there's this language barrier between the characters and these people.
Yeah.
Some of the, that stuff just comes across as really, really authentic and really kind of necessarily world building. Yeah.
I mean, are people just normally good at lying? Because, I mean, that's what acting is. Like, if you just react to someone and you just, like, play along with a lie.
Yeah.
That's...
Yeah, and I think if you just keep the cameras rolling, you know, and you just do a lot of improv and you just kind of, like, I think you'll eventually get to a place where these people will just start to behave naturally. That's my experience and my understanding of how these things can work well. I mean, I think the situations in which you need a trained professional actor is when mm-hmm. you have 20 minutes to get a scene in the can. They only get two or three takes to deliver lines that need to be delivered, like the pace the television is shot at.
Yeah.
You could never do this in television. This is only the kind of approach you could have when you have time.
Yes.
To really let those people get used to it's like reality television at that point. Let these people get used to cameras being around so that they forget it.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah. And then also we'll say, with film you can overshoot.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be a blessing or a curse, depending on how you take that. And like we said, there was like over 100 hours worth of film that they shot for this,
mm-hmm.
which is fucking insane.
Yeah. But if you have the time to deal with it, you know, like it's the slow, fast and cheap thing, right? Like if you have the time in editorial, if you have like a year or two to really find your movie in that 100 hours, you can come get something really special like this movie.
And I think it's The first cut that they had was 4 hours, which actually doesn't
make sense.
It's pretty normal. I think people would, have maybe made some films would be like, oh, that's how could you cut anything down from that? But that's pretty natural
normal.
For big feature films.
Yeah, totally. I mean, Equity, I think we had like a 3.5 hour cut in the first cut. And similarly for Fairy Goes Bang. But the problem, you know, the thing with those two movies is we were on these festival deadlines. You know, we were trying to make all these festival submission deadlines. And then when we got into various festivals, like just trying to get the movie done for those premieres and stuff, which is great. You know, these are great vehicles and platforms for your movies, obviously, to be shown. But it creates a kind of schedule around filmmaking, a self-imposed, you know, like totally like would take responsibility for imposing that on ourselves. But it creates these kind of deadlines around getting your movie done that may not service your movie in the way that it needs to be serviced. Like sometimes you should spend 4 years editing your movie, you know, like and finding the best
Terrence
version.
Malick-y.
I mean that's the thing. Maybe if you live and don't live in LA and don't have to pay rent here, then you can do that.
When you were editing Equity then, how did you decide what you were going to keep? And, you know, how did you work with your editor to figure out what was the essential part of the story that had to be there?
I was just through a lot of test screenings. We had to start, I mean, because we were trying to make Sundance and we were trying to make that deadline, we just started doing test screenings really early, like 3 weeks into editing the film, which is way too early. Again, like these are the things that I'd probably readjust just to kind of figure out just for myself to see what a different approach would yield. But for that movie, we just started testing in front of small groups, friends and family pretty early on. And then it kind of got bigger and bigger as we got closer to needing to finish. But it really, it's really just through showing it to other people and getting a sense of what are they seeing and what story are they getting that you can start to shape and whittle away and engage with the with the material.
Speaking of the overshooting and the letting all of that stuff go, one thing that I don't talk about too much on the podcast or that most people don't talk about is what role the DIT plays in a film and what that means for those who are unaware. It's basically an undersung hero on set. It's a person, you know, a team. Their job is to coordinate with the camera department to make a workflow, to make it all logical. Like they take all the footage off of the memory sticks and the SD cards and all of that stuff. And then they dump it and they organize it so that the editor can do, you know, rough cuts and assemblies as it goes. But they're doing it, you know, after everyone's shot. So the DIT on this is also the editor. So it was Colin Goody.
And so he was on set and stuff?
So they had the editor, which I think could be great because if your editor knows
amazing.
From the beginning, right?
Oh, that'd be incredible. And especially because of the visual effects element. I mean, my understanding of their workflow with this film, too, was that they were doing it all in the Adobe Creative Suite.
So. They were, yes. Anything that you can just get normally.
I know. It's so accessible. They were editing it in Premiere. They were doing the visual effects and like some combination of, I think, After Effects and Photoshop. And it's just like to be able to even just temp in that stuff as you're shooting to know what's working and what's not working and the plates you're getting. It's amazing. I think that's why it has such a coherent vision of its visual effects is because there was real-time processing of what they were getting and whether it was working or not. I mean, the shows I'm doing now have a lot of visual effects elements and so much of time is spent on set guessing whether or not. I mean, a visual effects supervisor is on set for that reason because they've put in their 10,000 hours with this stuff and know what things work and what don't work, but you're still just having to imagine on set, you know, whether or not that thing will fit in the space that you're providing it to. This like creature or whatever that needs to emerge from a character or the spell that's being cast or whatever it is. But if you could actually kind of rough in those ideas in real time on the day, it would be you can react to it in real time on the day.
I'm sure the editors would like that too.
Oh, totally.
Because the editors get my husband is an editor and he gets very pissed when. People don't think about those things.
Yeah,
but
I'm sure.
It's hard to manage.
Totally.
What the editor is going to need on set, you know, and
totally.
There's always something that might be missing.
Yeah.
I'm curious, you said the imagining spells and where they're going to fit. That's definitely the magicians, I would assume.
That's the magicians. Yeah. I'm just admit, there was this one day where we were, we had to, there was a version of the spell that one character was casting that had been done before in the previous season. So I knew the size of it roughly, but it was just, it became like the primary conversation on set was just making sure we were framing our shots so that we had room for this spell that that this character had to cast, and it just became, it just became kind of distracting from other things in the scene, the performances, the character beats, the dramatic beats between characters. You know, when everything becomes about everyone trying to imagine the same mm-hmm. thing in their, you know, connect their imaginations together, it just takes away time from those other things. Whereas if we just could drag and drop that spell into the shot as we were shooting it, just to roughly see where it would, so everyone could just see it, because that's the challenge on set as a director, is just getting everyone to see the same thing, right?
Yeah.
Because everyone has subjective vision. I mean, they read what's on the page and they are seeing it their own way. And so to get everyone on the same page as to what this thing will be is the task. It's a task in communication.
Which I find fascinating that, like, Gareth Edwards hadn't even in this movie, he was drawing like 150 different versions of what the monster could be after they shot.
Yeah.
So, I mean, conveying to his actors and to a cinematographer, you know, this is what it is going to look like.
Yeah.
He couldn't quite do that because he only had a few things. Like, he wanted it to be something that would be of the water. So, without legs, but still kind of tall. And
yeah.
So
I wonder if you, if got intel from the actors, if, what they had talked about on set is radically different from what ended up in the film. I'm sure it is, you know?
I would love to know.
You know, I'm sure it is, because you can only speculate in those moments unless you actually have decided on the idea ahead of time.
Have you ever had a moment where you're looking through the dailies or you're sorting through your footage and you find something that you didn't know was there that you love?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. Especially when we made Farrago's Bang, though, because similarly to Monsters, when you do found footage kind of on the streets, man on the street kind of stuff.
Yeah.
There's just background stuff happening that you have no idea that you're getting, you know, that you have no permission to be getting, but that you...
Was there anything specific that you remember from that shoot?
There probably is, but I'm actually thinking of a short film I made in college that I just shot on Oliveira Street. I shot a short film about Mark Sanford, imagining Mark Sanford, senator from South Carolina. I made a little short film about him when news broke that he was having an affair with this mistress, fleeing to Argentina and trying to find her and trying to convince her to run away with him and marry him and have a great love affair. And that's what the short film was about. But I shot it on Oliveira Street here during some festival, and we just shot the sequence of the guy that was playing Mark Sanford just wandering through these streets and all these. At some point, we were shooting towards some big gazebo, and he was walking right past it, and all these children started running in a circle around him,
mm-hmm.
and it was this perfect moment because it was very much about a guy who made a decision that will kind of destroy his family, to just have this kind of accidental moment of seeing him surrounded by all these kind of celebratory, kind of lively children was a total accident, but worked really well.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're going to take another quick break and then we'll come right back and we'll talk a little bit more about some visual effects stuff and also the atmosphere of shooting down there. Okay.
Hey guys, this is Adam Conover. You may know me from my True TV show, Adam Ruins Everything. Well, guess what? Now we're doing a podcast version right here on Maximum Fun. What we do is we take all the interesting, fascinating experts that we talk to for just a couple minutes on the show, and we sit with them for an entire podcast, really going deep and getting into the fascinating details of their work. Find Adam Ruins Everything wherever you get your podcasts or at MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm here talking to Mira Manon today about monsters.
Mm-hmm.
So, we had mentioned before that they were using off-the-shelf Adobe software to do the effects of mm-hmm. this, which I think is incredible. And also the fact that Gareth Edwards did all the visual effects himself, because he was a visual effects artist for a long time. And so he was just kind of in his bedroom office doing this for months and months and months at a time. Totally. And I love the idea that he had said in interviews that he didn't think it was going to take very long, because, you know, he had done work for other people and he's like, yes, you do a set thing. But when he had to start making decisions for himself on what something would look like specifically, it became much, much more difficult.
Right, because he didn't have a director telling him he was the director.
He was the director.
It becomes harder. Yeah, I mean, it's like, that's the other thing I love about this movie, is that it's probably one of the best examples of a bedroom movie, like the movie that you make in your bedroom, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's just the scale of it, you wouldn't think that would be able to be accomplished in that way. But because of, because of Adobe and, like, things like that, it's possible in a way that it wasn't before. It's exciting.
Yes. Now, you've edited a lot of your own work before.
Yeah, here and there. I mean, I edited, I co-edited Farrah Goes Bang with another editor. I edited, like, the short films I did in school. I worked as an editor a bit after Farrah. And the reason this movie has been one that's kind of surfaced for me again, the Monsters, is the one I'm kind of, like, thinking about a lot lately, is the next movie I want to make. I want to go back to that workflow a little bit. David Lowery, which is with The Ghost Story, recently got to talk to him, because he's directing the show Strange Angel for CBS All Access that I'll be doing later this spring. So I was, like, talking to him about his process, and he's been doing that for all of his movies, Ain't Them Body Saints. Like, did you do that with Pete's Dragon? He's like, yeah, I got in there with Pete's Dragon too. Like, it's like he's he works with editors, but he also makes sure that his hands are in there and pressing keys and, like, has that tactile relationship with the film he's making. And for me, that, I mean, Steven Soderbergh is another filmmaker I think of that, like, you can feel that. You can feel their fingerprints on the thing, because they're in there in that process, literally pushing the buttons, you know. And that's something I'd like to retain as a filmmaker. It's really easy once you have, like, more stuff and more bigger budgets, and especially, you know, and the TV thing is a whole other thing. But, like, but it's easy to get used to not doing that stuff, you know, when you don't have to. But I think it adds so much to the process and allows you to put your fingerprints on the film so much more effectively.
Have you thought about doing a monster movie or a sci-fi movie?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, for this reason, because I think at a low budget, you can execute on these things in bigger and kind of more impressionable ways, or more accurate ways than you ever have been able to do before. And just the allegories that, like, you're able to draw in these genres, I've kind of been more and more compelled by them. The more, kind of work I've done in TV with some of this stuff, and also just, like, kind of where we're at culturally. I just think this is, like, a space where you can draw out conversation in a way that is commercially impactful. It gets people actually watching your stuff, and also gets you, like, able and allows you to have the conversations you want to have. I mean, alien movies, I mean, I think in particular are great allegories for right now with immigration and just our lack of, you know, ability to kind of understand and communicate with one another. I think that there's a good space and opportunity right now for these kind of movies, and I'd love to make them.
I have been noticing. I mean, I've obviously been a horror and genre fan for a very long time, but it has been very heartening to see directors who've normally worked in dramas or comedies saying that they would like to experiment with that. If genre becomes mainstream, I'm fine with it.
Yeah.
You know, not protective of that whatsoever.
I was talking to a friend of mine, an Indian-American filmmaker, actress, about this kind of burgeoning interest of mine. She was like, you know, like, it's partially probably because you never grew up, you know, seeing yourself in those movies. There was a barrier of entry, you know, like, it was hard to identify with Elliot and E.T. You know, I love that movie, like, now, you know, but when I was a kid, you know, I was like, that's not necessarily, but A Wrinkle in Time, I mean, just speaking about A Wrinkle in Time, which I haven't seen, I'm so excited to see, but this is the kind of thing that can really present a sea change in younger women, definitely women of color, being able to see themselves in these movies and then imagine making them.
Yes.
You know?
I think that we're about there, and, you know, we're trying to get it on the ground floor. I want to talk a little bit about the troubles that Edwards faced when he was shooting in South America. I know we had touched on that a little bit, but I found this really interesting because he was shooting, I think it was in Central America where they were, when he was noticing a bunch of armed guards were following them around. And he got really excited because he was like, oh, this is wonderful. Like, I can just shoot them. And then he understood for a second. He was just like, oh, wait, these are the same guards. And then one of the people on set was like, they're... like the government paid for these for free for us so that mm-hmm. we don't get kidnapped. And he was like, oh, well, that's interesting.
Wow, jeez.
And so he said, quote, there's an amazing contradiction at the heart of Central America, potential trouble right alongside beauty and friendship. Many bad things happened while we were there. There were shootings outside the hotel. We got caught in the middle of a street market attack on a thief. A local prison had a riot and decapitated some of the inmates and displayed their heads by the fence. Some gang machine gunned down everyone in a village cafe a week before we arrived. Swine flu broke out. Oh, my God. But while all this was going on, we were in some of the most beautiful places I'd ever seen, being helped by the most generous people in the world. This strange contrast started to infect the film. Even in the most beautiful place, danger could be just around the corner or during an intimidating situation where the friendless people ready to help you. While I was watching this film, I have to say that I was struck by how ultimately positive it felt. And even though it you know, things are terrible. They're the worst things are happening. It still felt like there was some kind of positivity or hope for the future, even though the worst things are happening.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's still some, like, goodness there.
In interacting with the people, I'm sure, and,
yeah.
like, kind of engaging with them and bringing them into his movie and stuff
yeah.
like is that maybe what he was pointing to, just, like, kind of actually being able to, you know, it's one thing to read the headline. It's another thing to go there, I'm sure, and engage with these people and recognize these are just ordinary people living their lives, kind of the way the movie kind of constructs reality and situates these characters in a world where something catastrophic has happened, but you still have people just living their lives in a pretty ordinary way. I mean, that whole sequence where these two characters are eating corn and drinking tequila and having fun, you know,
yeah.
like it's a really remark. And then somewhere in that sequence, you see them detour into a candlelight vigil that's honoring all these children that have died at the hands of these monsters or at the claws or at the tendrils of these
yeah,
monsters?
Whatever. They're suckers? Do they have like little, I don't know.
I don't know. They're like these like rat, like kind of totally gnarly octopuses or something.
Yeah, like water spiders that I'm yeah. really freaked out by.
Yeah, totally. Like just the ordinariness of that sequence coupled with the reminder of these extraordinary circumstances is what makes the film so powerful, like, or in that moment really powerful. Yeah.
It's... I mean, I don't know that he had that in mind, you know, when he was making this. I think they were just trying to make something, you know, on the cheap, right?
Yeah, right.
But I think it is fascinating, you know. It makes me wonder, you know, what kind of stories we could be telling if we were
right.
actually working with filmmakers and people in Central America more and
right.
really telling those stories.
Right.
The vigil that you mentioned is something I definitely wanted to touch on because
yeah.
I don't have any confirmation, but that vigil seemed very off the cuff in that it
yeah.
may be a vigil of some other sort of...
Probably, right? Yeah,
yes.
Like that they found it and he found a way to stitch it into the story because it's not the... Given their parameters for shooting this thing, I'm sure that there was no way they could set up anything and that he was constructing storylines around what they were just finding on
yeah.
the street. But yeah.
But it makes the story more poignant to me, especially if you think about any of like the kind of like cartel violence that
absolutely
breaks out in Mexico and South America, and the very innocent civilians who take the toll of all of this violence.
Yeah,
and you know, from what he says happened while they were there, it's very probable that these people that we're seeing pictures of in this vigil were victims of some kind of violence in that manner, which seems like a really like a difficult thing to tackle in a movie.
Yeah, I mean, he's writing a line there. I mean, I'm not sure. Yeah, it would be interesting to know what the context around that vigil was, because then what is your responsibility as a witness? There's the side of you, I'm sure, in that situation. That's the filmmaker that
mm-hmm.
is telling the story for the film that you sold to this company that you're now trying to execute on and get made.
Yeah.
And then there's the side that of you and the actors and everyone that's there that are just people that are... Yeah, yeah, bearing witness to these situations in this environment, probably for the first time, I would imagine. You know?
Yeah. What do you think the responsibility of the filmmaker is in a kind of morally complicated situations?
I mean, it's interesting, right? I mean, I think definitely being truthful to the sense of life and vitality around you at all, especially in that situation where you are just using what's around your environment to tell your story. Being truthful to all sides of the life and vitality around you. So these kind of things, the sadness and the kind of the tragedy that can elicit kind of these images of the candlelight vigil, coupled with the joy of like eating at a food cart on the side of the street and interacting with a bartender, showing the full spectrum, I think then becomes your responsibility. If you are using these people in their environment to tell your story, I think that might be what you'd owe to them is to present a truly full picture of life.
Do you feel that that's something that you try to uphold or adhere to when you're writing new work? You know, if you're going into a place or an area of people's stories where you are the outsider.
Yeah. No. Totally. Totally. I mean, I'm very much at a point as a filmmaker where I'm still struggling to figure out how to tell my own perspective, my own story, my own people's story. And I'm going being Indian American, I'm still trying to figure out how to tell those stories effectively and with the fullness of the kind of complexity of all that stuff that involves. But were I to be in a situation to go into another country and tell other people's stories, I mean, there have definitely been scripts and stuff I've discussed and talked to people about that take place in the Congo, take place in like all kinds of places around the world. And I think if I were to make movies like that, I would approach it with a kind of I'd try and approach it with a kind of journalistic integrity of like doing my homework and understanding and trying to get as much information as possible before hitting the record button. You know?
I like this idea of approaching it as a journalist. That's the way I felt like Sean Baker, I think, is a filmmaker who approaches things as a journalist.
Totally. And there's such a, you feel that in his films, that there's such a respect for the subject that he's representing. And I think that part of that must come from a true collaboration between him and the people that he's documenting, you know? The kind of breaking down that kind of archetype of director as kind of omniscient, all-knowing, paternalistic, God.
I mean, so it's not, I mean, the way that you're approaching directing is not from a paternalistic, but from a
therapeutic, like journalistic, conversational, kind of like this place of wanting to use where I'm coming from and the person I'm working with, where they're coming from, to kind of cohere into something bigger and better that's greater than the sum of their parts. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's a perfect place to end today. Thank you so much for coming in and talking with me about this movie. And I'm so happy that you introduced me to it.
Glad. Oh, I'm glad I did. It was just really fun to talk about. Like, didn't sleep last night. I thought this would be a struggle. But I was like, no, I really love talking about this with you.
To every future guest, it's actually very easy to talk about things.
Right. It's like, oh, right. I like movies. You're making this very easy.
It's the best part. I love having directors in who forgot that they really just liked movies and talking about movies.
Yeah, no, this was actually really soul-enriching. It's been a really tough experience on set. This was like, oh, that's a good reminder.
Hi, this is April coming to you from the future where she has a cold. Wanting to thank you for listening to this episode of Switchblade Sisters. Next week, we'll be talking to screenwriter Liz Hanna. She wrote this year's The Post. She'll be on to discuss The Silence of the Lambs. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air in this very sultry voice that I have right now. D. Durand says, kudos to one of the most thought-provoking podcasts out there as each episode delves below the surface of the genre films we love. I really enjoy hearing the thoughts from women in the business as they discuss their backgrounds and their current and past projects. Keep up the great work. I also enjoy hearing them talk about their past projects. And then we've got Nova Shoshi, who says, in a world where equal cinematic representation is very lacking, it is great to have a podcast where women with critical and creative experience in the film industry give their perspectives about awesome genre films and also have a place to plug their current work. Thanks for the great discussions and recommendations and for exposing listeners like me to the work of the amazing guests that may have flown under the radar. If you're like me, your watch list has probably grown huge, Nova Joshi. And then there's Vicky71, who says, great interviews, adds to my must-see movie queue weekly, and keeps me company when my office mate is whinging on and on. Love the podcast. I love our international listeners who get to use words like whinging, because that's not in my normal vocabulary, and I love it. And if you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. And please check out our Facebook group, facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. This is a production of MaximumFun.org.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.